headlines this hour. Iran's most senior military commander visits an underground base which houses a huge fleet of cutting-edge Iranian drones. One day ahead of Israel's flag march, Palestinian groups warn that they are ready for confrontation as Israel refuses to change the planned route of the parade. Also, the battle for Ukraine's Donbas region intensifies as Russia captures the strategic town of Lyman en route to two key cities still under Kyiv's control. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian military has turned to the number one drone power in the region. Chairman of the Armed Forces Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, has paid a visit to an underground drone base. The top general got a first-hand account of the Iranian Army's cutting-edge capabilities in the development of different types of military, combat, and long-range drones. Images released show the Kaiman 12 drone with a flight endurance of 12 hours. It is capable of carrying four domestically produced bombs and missiles. Iran has always stressed such programs are part of boosting the country's defenses. The fate of the 2015 Iran deal remains far from clear as talks between Tehran and the P4+1 group are stalled. As we will see in the next report, Iran says the main remaining issue in the talks is about its right to economic and trade benefits under the JCPOA.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stresses that what has caused the pause in the negotiations is Iran's economic and trade demands, and the most important remaining issue is the effective removal of economic sanctions. The top diplomat says the maximum pressure campaign launched by former U.S. President Donald Trump must end. He says the window of diplomacy is still open, adding that Americans know what they need to do.
U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
Palestinian resistance groups are warning Israel ahead of the regime's provocative flag march in occupied outlets. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups say that they would retaliate if Israel does not change the planned route of the parade and tries to approach Al-Aqsa Mosque. People's Youth Movement in Al-Quds says it wants Sunday to be remembered as Palestinian Flag Day by raising the national flag on every house, square, and street. Israeli groups hold annual events to commemorate the occupation of the Old City and other Palestinian neighborhoods in 1967. A similar rally last year ended with Israeli crackdown and retaliatory rocket attacks by Hamas that led to an 11-day war on Gaza. Regime officials say that a series of raids and arrests are expected across the occupied territories ahead of the planned march. This day 94 of the Russia-Ukraine war, Russian forces are making advances in eastern Ukraine. Let's take a look at the latest developments. Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kyiv's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbas city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. The Luhansk governor says that Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. He says Ukrainian forces may have to retreat from the strategic city to avoid capture. Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in late February. The war has displaced over 12 million Ukrainians, more than half of them internally. Ukraine's president says his country will do whatever it takes to defend the eastern region of Donbas, where Russian forces are conducting a fierce offensive. Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of carrying out genocide in Donbas. He says the Russians have concentrated maximum artillery and reserves in that region, targeting it with missile strikes and aircraft attacks. The fighting in Donbas has been raging over the past few weeks. Some Ukrainian officials say Kyiv's troops may now have to retreat from some key areas to avoid being captured. Some 10,000 Russian troops are reportedly stationed in Donbas. That makes up the Luhansk and Donetsk provinces. The Russian president says Moscow is ready to help find ways to ship grain stuck in Ukrainian ports during the conflict. Vladimir Putin made the announcement in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Putin said that Russia is also ready to help reduce tensions in the global food market by increasing its export of fertilizers and agricultural products. He said this, however, requires the removal of relevant Western sanctions on Russia. Putin pointed to the Western arms supplies to Ukraine, warning that they risk, quote, further destabilization. He also touched upon stalled diplomatic efforts aimed at ending the war with Ukraine, saying that Moscow is ready to resume negotiations. Scholz and Macron asked Putin to hold serious and direct negotiations with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on North Korea, this one day after Russia and China vetoed a Washington-led push for more U.N. embargoes on the East Asian country over its recent missile launches. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter in depth.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the United States has hit North Korea with new sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has blacklisted two Russian banks and a North Korean company and an individual. It said Washington would continue to implement sanctions, but urged the North to return to a diplomatic path. The move came a day after China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push for more U.N. sanctions over North Korea's missile launches. In a joint statement later, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea strongly condemned the North's recent ballistic missile launches. Talks on Pyongyang's denuclearization have been stalled since a summit with the U.S. collapsed in 2019. North Korea says its nuclear and missile programs are to counter hostile U.S. policies. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Frank Smith, who's joining us live from Seoul, and also John Stepling, author and commentator. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with our correspondent, Frank. Is the U.S. policy towards North Korea growing more confrontational, in your opinion?
Well, I think we have to look at the South Korean context to analyze this. Here in South Korea on May 10th, they inaugurated a new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, and he's campaigned upon a promise of strengthening the U.S. alliance. He's also suggested that he wanted to deploy another THAAD battery, that's a terminal high altitude area defense anti-ballistic missile system made by the U.S., costs $1 billion, and it's aimed at, you know, protecting South Korea and can also be reconfigured in terms of its satellite imagery and surveillance into China. So it defends China as well. Yoon Suk-yeol, President Yoon here in South Korea, also wants the military to design a preemptive strike on North Korea should it appear that North Korea is going to launch a missile towards South Korea. South Korea has also purchased tens of billions of dollars of U.S. weapons recently, including 40 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft. So, you know, when we talk about the hostile U.S. policy, we also have to look at the South Korean policy in terms of what Kim Jong-un and North Korea is referring to from the U.S. It's the U.S. support of United Nations Security Council sanctions and the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed here in South Korea. Those are really the things that North Korea is talking about in terms of Washington.
Okay, so Mr. Stepling, North Korea also seems to be upping the ante in its confrontation with the U.S. We've seen multiple missile launches recently, three right after Biden left the region days ago. Why is that?
Well, look, I mean, the U.S. hypocrisy in these matters is jaw-dropping. It always has been. It continues to be. The U.S. tests missiles, you know, weekly. It has military tests and exercises around the world at its 900-plus military bases every day. I mean, so the U.S. exhibits this American exceptionalism and points its finger at North Korea. The North Korean economy has really suffered from sanctions. It suffered from a lockdown due to the COVID pandemic, whether, you know, that kind of lockdown was justified or not. It certainly hurt the economy, and the economy in North Korea shrank for the first time, I think, since 2017. What North Korea did, all of this is operative on a symbolic level, essentially. All they did was test a missile. And there's some question about whether it was really the missile they claimed it to be. But it doesn't matter. North Korea is in a desperate situation. And the U.S. statement is just drenched in hypocrisy. And when they, they say North Korea should return to the negotiating table, it's the U.S. who has refused to negotiate, just like with the Ukraine and Russia conflict. Russia had gone to the U.N., gone to the U.S., asked to negotiate. North Korea has been very amenable to negotiation, but been rebuffed by the U.S. and U.N. And the U.N. is nothing more than a rubber stamp, essentially, for the U.S. So the ascension of a very far right-wing president in South Korea is indeed very telling and bad, and it's another example of this sort of rehabilitated fascism that is taking place globally. This is a guy who ran, as your other guest noted, on a platform that targeted very aggressive actions, targeted North Korea for very aggressive actions, and amped up the rhetoric of threat and fear throughout his campaign. So the U.S. is just, North Korea is not really an issue. It's a sort of back burner issue for the Biden administration. It's not that important, except as it affects the Russia-Ukraine conflict and except as it affects relationships with China. But the U.S., how many countries? There's like 8 countries now suffering sanctions from the U.S., and none of them are justified. All of them are taking place in the make-believe world of American exceptionalism.
Okay, that's all the time that we have. John Stepling, author and commentator, our correspondent Frank Smith from Seoul. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. We now present you an article written jointly by Rowena Mason and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Boris Johnson Accused of Changing Ministerial Code to Save His Skin. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been accused of changing the ministerial code to help save his skin, ahead of a new Partygate inquiry that could publish more photographs and subject him to a public grilling by MPs. The Prime Minister faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. Under new sanctions, they could apologise or temporarily lose their pay instead. Boris Johnson also blocked his independent ethics chief, Christopher Guyot, from gaining the power to launch his own investigations and rewrote the foreword to the Ministerial Code of Conduct, removing all references to honesty, integrity, transparency, and accountability. It comes as the Prime Minister faces an inquiry by the Privileges Committee into whether he misled Parliament over lockdown parties at No. 10 Downing Street, which could itself be a breach of the ministerial code. Labour and the Liberal Democrats accused Boris Johnson of rigging the system to get himself off the hook ahead of the inquiry. No. 10 Downing Street said a new version of the ministerial code, published on Friday, 27th of May, alongside a government statement saying it is disproportionate to expect that any breach, however minor, should lead automatically to resignation or dismissal, has the backing of the Committee on Standards in Public Life and Lord Gate, the advisor on ministerial interests. British ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament are usually expected to resign, which is stated elsewhere in the Code of Conduct. However, Downing Street declined to say if Boris Johnson would resign if found to have done so. One reason given for changing the rules was to avoid incentives for trivial or vexatious complaints, which may be made for partisan reasons. Chris Bryant, the Labour MP and chair of the Parliament's Standards Committee, said the weakening of the system was appalling. Chris Bryant said, "The new ministerial code is a disgrace. It means that the tiny semblance of accountability disappears. If you break the rules, just rewrite the rulebook," is the motto of this despicable government. Johnson remains under severe pressure over Partygate after the publication of the Sue Gray report. On Friday, 27th of May, he suffered the first loss of a front bencher since the report. Ministerial aide Paul Holmes, who said his work as an MP had been tarnished by the toxic culture that seemed to have permeated No. 10 Downing Street. Bob Neil, a former minister and chair of the Justice Committee, also revealed he submitted a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson recently. He said these events have undermined trust in not just the office of the Prime Minister, but in the political process itself. To rebuild that trust and move on, a change in leadership is required. Bob Neil later told the BBC that the change to the ministerial code of practice was not a wise move. Rebel MPs are planning to use next week's recess to plot ways to oust the Prime Minister. One critic said the number of letters of no confidence had to be in the 40s, short of the 54 required to trigger a confidence vote, but more than the almost 30 MPs who have gone public with criticisms of Boris Johnson. A senior Conservative MP said, "Boris Johnson's value to the party as Prime Minister is now exhausted, and events will take their natural course. I cannot tell you whether it will crystallise on 6th of June. after recess or 27th of June, the return to Parliament after two by-elections. But the parliamentary party knows it cannot fight and win the next election under Boris. There is a widening gulf between the expectations of Johnson's allies and his critics, who expect to see him gone before the summer. One cabinet minister said he did not believe that Sue Gray's report had changed people's mind. He said either people are already bored of it or they are permanently enraged by it. I'm not sure anything is going to change now. But despite this confidence, Boris Johnson is facing a new headache with the start of the Privileges Committee inquiry within weeks, which is likely to keep Partygate in the headlines. Separately, it is understood the Greater London Authority's Oversight Committee is soon due to publish a report looking into London and Partners, the promotional agency linked to Boris Johnson's time as London Mayor, and the revelations about his relationship with a US businesswoman, Jennifer Arcuri. Three ministerial aides, Laura Farris, Alberto Costa and Andy Carter, are imminently expected to resign from their government jobs in order to be more independent as members of the Privileges Committee that will sit in judgment over the Prime Minister's honesty. It is expected to launch within weeks before the summer break and to last four or more months. The committee can sit in private or call witnesses in public, potentially including Boris Johnson himself, and demand further documentary evidence, such as photographs from the government if required. Sue Gray published only 9 photographs in her report, but hundreds were seen by her inquiry. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with a probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed. Boris Johnson could be found in contempt of Parliament if he deliberately misled the House of Commons, but he could also be in breach of the Ministerial Code of Conduct if he knowingly lied to MPs. However, the Ministerial Code is governed by the Prime Minister himself, and Boris Johnson resisted pressure to give Lord Gyte the power to launch his own inquiries without consent. Under his revised terms of reference, there will be an enhanced process to let Lord Gyte initiate inquiries, but he will still require the Prime Minister's consent before going ahead. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with a probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to talk about the character of Imam As-Sadiq, alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What did it mean to be a Shia of Imam Sadiq? What did it mean? We're trying to learn a lesson, brothers and sisters, so that we can ready ourselves for the Imam of the time. One of the stories that we've heard, many of us have heard this story about the Qiyam of the Abbasids that took place in the life of Imam Sadiq. Maybe we've heard of a man named Abu Muslim. Abu Muslim was a commander of the Abbasid army, and he came to the Imam. And before the Abbasids announced their government, he brought a letter. There were others. They said that, "Will you rule us? Will you be the leader?" And the Imam famously said, he says, "Ma anta min rijali, you're not one of my men. Wala zaman, zamani, this time is not my time." So back to our question. What was it like, or what did it mean to be one of the men of Imam Sadiq? What was the time of Imam Sadiq like? What did it mean to be one of his Shia? That he would tell this man who's leading a powerful army, leading a political movement, that you are not one of my men, and this is not my time. What we find our senior scholars saying is this. This is something for us, again, to do tarbiyah of ourselves. The term Shia, in the time of the Ahlul Bayt, it was not used as loosely as it is today. It wasn't just used for those who love the Ahlul Bayt. There are many who love the Ahlul Bayt. It wasn't even used for those who are ideological in this way, that they believed that the imams were appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They were the khulafa of Rasulullah. Rather, the term Shia had a special meaning back in those days. The term was used for those who not only believed, but were actively resisting, along with the imam, to wrest political power from the tawaghit and give it back to the imam. Those people were considered the Shia. That term was used for them. Because the Ahlul Bayt, they had to establish the kingdom of God on the earth, but the way to do that was going to be through resistance. You see, if you look at the lives of the Ahlul Bayt big picture, you'll see that there was a strategy that they employed. And then after that, inshallah, it'll make sense of what Imam Sadiq was doing. The strategy of the Ahlul Bayt was this. They wanted to spread the teachings of Islam far and wide. The idea was, if the teachings of Islam spread far and wide, a number of the people will embrace Islam. They will love Islam. They will accept its ideology, its principles, its jurisprudence. These people will long for the kingdom of God on the earth. Once I've embraced Islam, once I know who the Ahlul Bayt are, why wouldn't I want that there be Islam on the face of the earth? How would I live? But the imams didn't only do that. They also had another mission, and that is to raise and train a select group of determined individuals. A small group of determined individuals who would resist alongside the imam. These were the Shia of the imam. They had special instructions from the imam. These were the people, if you hear a hadith where the Imam Sadiq is saying, "Don't share our secrets," it's that group that he's talking about. Not the people who are teaching ahkam. The imam was teaching ahkam openly. Who were the people who were keeping the secrets of them? These were people who would get the monies of the imam to where it needed to be. They would pass the message of the imam. The imam is living in Medina. Why would people in Morocco know what the imam's saying? It would be through this line of the Shia. Those who were resisting, actively part of this. These individuals, if they were captured by the Tawhut, they would suffer torture. They would be beheaded. They're trying to fight. This is an underground organization resisting, actively involved with the imam. Not just that I like the imam. Not just that I believe in the imam. I'm trying to help make this happen. So what happened is, all of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, they had this policy. And when you see the term Shia, and I'm going to talk about this underground organization and what it was doing and what happened in the time of Imam Sadiq, and then also, unfortunately, how the organization failed. But what happened is this small group of determined individuals who was resisting, who gave shuhada, it was there in the time of Imam Amirul Mu'mineen and the other imams. This group was there. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the situation that was there in the time of Imam Sadiq, why things were so different, so ripe for a qiyam. So, having said that, those are the two main policies. So now back to what our imam was doing. Remember, our imam wants to establish the divine government on the face of the earth. He wants the people of the world to know Islam. And it makes sense. We want something that the people want. They know. It's not we're tricking. It's not going to be imposed. So the imam has to spread that knowledge far and wide as far as he can. That intellectual growth has to happen to the masses. That they embrace Islam's teachings. When I say intellectual growth, brothers and sisters, it doesn't mean the standard, well, I have a PhD. No, no. Intellectual growth in the Islamic sense. Aql, as defined by Ahlul Bayt, is different from Western intellectual growth. The Prophet said, Al-Aqlu maktusiba bihil Jannah. True intellect. Intellectual growth that's going to ready the ground for the coming of the imam is that intellect that leads to attaining paradise. That's aql. In addition to that, for the masses again, that longing had to be developed for the kingdom of God on the earth. Allah doesn't impose His magnificent blessing. You have to want that. The masses have to be determined for that. As it says in the Quran, لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْ. That the masses rise up for justice. You and I, right now, we should be hearing the footsteps of the Mahdi. Right now, you're slowly, I'm not saying we're there yet. We have work to do. The masses, لِيَقُومَ النَّاسِ. The people have to rise up for justice. But they have to know what they're getting into. In the light of that, you see that our imam, and it was unprecedented, the amount of ulum of Ahlul Bayt, spreading and teaching Islam that took place in the time of Imam Sadiq didn't happen for any imam before and not for any after. Spreading the message. But that was only one part of the mission. You see, when the imam did this, there were a couple of things that the imam was doing with this by spreading Islam in the right way. One of them was the logic of the Ahlul Bayt was that the person who had this divine knowledge should be obeyed. The imam is someone who's not just your political leader. They have that divine knowledge. They're telling you what God said. They know the religion of Islam. Listen to this one beautiful hadith of the imam. He says this from Imam Sadiq. وَلَا تُنَازِ الْعَمْرَ أَهْلَهُ. Never dispute with the person who is rightfully the leader, rightfully in charge. Don't do tanazo. Don't fight with this person. Don't dispute with this person. At the same time, the imam says something else. وَلَا تُطِعِ السُّفَهَاءَ. Also, don't obey those who are safi, naive. Now, there are so many applications to this. Discussions that we have from our scholars on just this one line of Imam Sadiq. But one part that we're trying to use right now is according to the mantiq and the logic of the Ahlul Bayt, those who are actively working for their own destruction and the destruction of mankind, they're naive. How could I work for the destruction of myself? If you're a taghut and you're committing sins that no human being can commit. How could that be a good thing? This person is safi in the mantiq of the Ahlul Bayt. And the Ahlul Bayt had this logic that they would try to teach people. So the imams, that was one of the things they were doing. There was something else too. The imams knew the only way for the tawaghit to exist and to run the affairs of the people was when Islam was not known in its true sense. When people had deviated from true Islam, when the teachings which were supposed to liberate were used to put people to sleep, that's when a taghut could come into power. even more important than dismantling the political apparatus of the Taghut was to cut the life vein of the system of the Tawaghit by protecting Islam from deviation and introducing Islam as is. If Islam was introduced as is, the natural result was someone like Imam Sadiq had to leave, to lead.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Russian military operation in Ukraine has captured the attention of the world, and the Western powers are arming, funding, and providing political and humanitarian support for the Ukrainians. Meanwhile, Palestine has slipped off the global agenda, and besieged, blockaded, and bombed Gaza has become invisible. Dear listeners, we now present you an article in this regard written by Michael Jensen, a political commentator. The piece is titled, The Zionist Regime Setting Gazans Adrift from National Identity and Nullifying Their Claim to Palestine. Please stay tuned. On February 23rd, the day before the Russian operation in Ukraine, Al-Haq, the Palestinian human rights organization, released a report entitled Cultural Apartheid, Israel's Erasure of Palestinian Heritage in Gaza. The report is based on an investigation by Forensic Architecture, a research organization based in London, which managed to virtually reconstruct key ancient sites in the Israeli-occupied and bombarded Gaza Strip. Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture accused the Zionist regime of using strategic strikes to erase Gaza's rich cultural heritage, thereby denying Palestinians, as Al-Haq put it, the right to self-determination over their cultural resources, and by extension, threatens their existence as a people. Around 12,000 archaeological sites have been surveyed in the Palestinian territories since 1967 Israeli regime occupation. Three West Bank Palestinian sites have been chosen for UNESCO's World Heritage List: the Church of Nativity in Beit Lahm, the Old City of Al-Khalil, and the cultural landscape of northern Al-Quds around the village of Batir. UNESCO dubbed the latter Palestine Land of Olives and Vines, as the hills around Batir is terraced for olive orchards and vegetable gardens, which are watered by traditional underground networks. Since the old city in Al-Quds and its walls are disrupted, UNESCO has not assigned them to either Palestine or the regime of Israel. The state of Palestine has submitted three sites in Gaza to UNESCO for consideration. Situated near Al-Shati refugee camp, Antidon Harbor is the oldest known port on Gaza Mediterranean coast. Antidon Harbor, which was seriously damaged during the Zionist regime's 2021 bombing of Gaza, was inhabited between 800 BC to 1100 AD and served as a major trading hub on the commercial route between Europe and the Levant. The ancient Roman settlement of Tel Omer, the birthplace of Saint Hilarion near Al-Nusayrat village on Gaza coast, the settlement was located on the road connecting Mesopotamia to Egypt. One of the most important coastal wetlands on the eastern Mediterranean is Wadi Gaza, which stretches 105 kilometers from the Negev Hills and the southern Al-Khalil Heights to the east Gaza and follows a circuitous route for 7 kilometers through Gaza. The wetlands are not only rich in diversity of flora and fauna, but also a staging area for migratory birds. These sites delve deep into Gaza's history as a land bridge between Egypt and Mesopotamia, Iraq, and the Levant, and on the continental scale between Africa and West Asia. Gaza was a crossroads of multiple civilizations: Egyptian, Greek, Mesopotamian, Persian, and Arab, to name the key empires which impacted on this narrow coastal strip until the Zionist regime occupied the lands, imprisoned Palestinians, and halted traffic along the Palestinian coast. During its 1948-49 war, the regime of Israel drove the inhabitants from cities, towns, and villages into Gaza, where refugees now count for 70% of the strip's 2.1 million people. The destructive impact of this influx and long-term presence on Gaza's rich cultural heritage cannot be calculated. Contractors building housing, infrastructure, and manufacturing plants have both destroyed heritage sites and made extensive collections of ancient Greek pottery, coins, and Islamic relics, while fishermen and swimmers continue to discover and sell antiquities washed onto beaches or dredged up from the sea. In 2008, builder Jawad Qudri opened a one-room museum called Al-Madhaf to display some of his treasures. Located off the coast near the Shati refugee camp, Al-Madhaf welcomes busloads of school children who have little knowledge of the long history of their beleaguered and impoverished. In January 2009, Al-Madhaf was struck by shrapnel and pottery smashed when the Israeli regime bombed the nearby sports field during its 2008-2009 attack on Gaza. A second museum has been opened at Al-Gharara, an ancient site south of Gaza City by Muhammad and Najla Abu Lahia. The collection features artifacts from 4000 BC through the Roman, Byzantine, early Islamic, and Ottoman empires, and includes wooden plows, horse saddles, baskets, and items used half a century ago. During Israeli regime's 2014 offensive, Al-Haq reported the destruction of 61 and damage to 120 mosques and partial damage to a church. During the May 2021, the Israeli regime assault, both ancient and modern and heritage sites were targeted or indirectly damaged due to bombing of nearby areas as well as 124 places of worship. Among the sites struck were the Great Umari Mosque, the second oldest in Palestine, the Kitab al-Walaya Mosque, the historic Church of Saint Porphyrius, and Tal Amr, and the ruins of Saint Hilarion Monastery. Al-Haq has called on the International Criminal Court to initiate prosecutions of the Zionist regime for targeting cultural property, as this fundamentally affects the core of Palestinians' identity and their existence as people and constitutes a crime against humanity. Furthermore, destruction of cultural heritage, which takes place under an illegal apartheid regime, is also a crime against humanity. By destroying Palestinian connections to their land, the civilizations which have ruled Gaza and its distinctive culture, the regime of Israel seeks to set Gazans adrift from their national identity and nullify their claim to Palestine. This is what Daesh tried to do so by devastating the heritage of Syria and Iraq with the aim of destroying the millennial identities of Syrians and Iraqis so they would submit to the outfit harsh, uncivilized regime.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In my opinion, there are two important qualities that constituted his personality. One is his firm determination and another is his insight. We must promote these qualities as much as we can. One is firm determination. Sometimes we believe in something but do not act on it because of our weak willpower. Having a firm willpower plays a decisive role. Hazrat Hamza became a Muslim in the 8th year of the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha. Those days were the hardest days for the Holy Prophet because Islam had just become announced publicly and the Holy Prophet and his companions were being attacked from all sides. The hardships that we have heard of are related to those years. During those very difficult circumstances for Muslims, that personality shouted in Masjid al-Haram next to Kaaba that he had become a Muslim and that he had believed in the Holy Prophet's religion. Such was his courage, his firm determination, and his insight.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Gaining a correct understanding of things is very important. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.